Hello, I'm Crystal Upperman. I'm a research scientist in the field of climate change and public health. I've worked with health departments in Maryland and Washington, D.C., and did my dissertation research at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Health Statistics. Today, I'm covering guidance issued by the World Health Organization and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention around our response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Before I moved into some of the guidance that has been issued, I wanted to take a moment to go over just the current timeline of events that we've experienced over the past couple of months. We know that on December 31st, Wuhan, China declared its first unknown case of pneumonia. And then after that, we see on January 17th that it was at that point that China reported its second fatality, and the United States began initiating screening of passengers arriving from Wuhan, China, flying into airports in San Francisco, New York City, and Los Angeles. And then January 21st was when the US confirmed its first case of COVID-19. And at that point in time, China reported having 300 cases. And also, the NIH began working on a vaccine for COVID-19. On January 26th, we see that the US government announced that they are chartering special flights between Wuhan and San Francisco Airport to evacuate US citizens, which was supposed to happen on January 28th. And at the same point in time, the United States confirmed that there was a third case of COVID infection in Orange County, California. On January 29th, we saw that, that flight coming from Wuhan, the United States evacuated nationals from Wuhan, China. And then on January 30th was when sort of the big spiral began, where we saw that the WHO declared the outbreak a public health emergency of international concern. And at this point, it was when the US reported its first confirmed case of person-to-person transmission. So at this point, there was no longer any travel-related, it was not only travel-related infection, but also the virus was being passed from person to person. From February 1st to the 24th, a series of things happened. Cases began to increase mildly. But at this point, we see that the United States began to deny entry to foreign nationals who visited China in the last 2 weeks. And then at that point, we saw US cases from that time frame, we saw US cases go from 11 to 53. Then on February 27th, we see that the United States confirmed its first unknown source case. This indicated that there is or was at that point in time a community transmission happening. And at that point in time, we had a total of 60 cases, 42 of which were repatriated from the Diamond cruise ship, as you all likely remember. And on February 29th, the US had reported its first fatality, which was a man in his 50s who also had underlying conditions. And then from March 11th to the 13th, the WHO, characterizes COVID-19 as a pandemic. And then we see the United States step in and restrict travel from Europe for 30 days. At that point in time, our death toll was at 39, and the total number of cases drastically rose to 1,300. And at this point in time, we see that the United States began to implement more measures to contain the spread. On March 14th, the US declared a national emergency. At that point in time, the death toll rose to 57, and the total number of cases rose to 2,900. On March 17th, we see that the White House began urging the public to avoid gatherings of more than 10 people. And then the government began calling for closures of bars and gyms just earlier this week, and restaurants. And then we see the death toll standing at 85 and total number of cases at 4,660. We also see on March 17th, the US clinical trial for COVID-19 began. And where we stand at on March 19th is that the global death toll has risen to 9,843, with the total number of cases surpassing 242,000. So what do we know about COVID-19? What we know is that COVID-19 is a coronavirus disease. It's a respiratory illness that can spread from person to person. And the virus that causes COVID-19 is a novel coronavirus that was first identified during an investigation at an unknown outbreak in Wuhan, China. The virus is currently called SARS-CoV-2. And then also, everyone's been asking, can I get COVID-19? The answer is absolutely yes. COVID-19 is spreading from person to person in various parts of the world. The risk of infection from a virus that causes COVID-19 is higher for people who are close or come in close contact with someone known to have COVID-19. For example, healthcare workers or household members of a person that's infected are at higher risk. Other people at high risk for infection are those who live or have recently been in an area with an ongoing spread of COVID-19. How does the virus spread? The virus that causes COVID-19 probably merged from an animal source, but is now spreading from person to person. There are still studies that are investigating where it could have originated. It's postulated to be potentially from bats and then spending some time in another intermediary host, potentially pangolins, but that research is inconclusive at this point. We won't know until later. But it is possible that this virus can be spread from person to person by touching a surface or an object that has the virus on it, and then a person touching either their mouth, nose, or possibly their eyes. Recent studies have shown that, you know, the duration to which the virus remains suspended in aerosolized air is about 3 hours. It can also, you know, have a longer staying duration on surfaces such as plastic, cardboard, stainless steel. And that research is still ongoing and becoming conclusive in terms of, you know, how directly it's transmitted. But for what we know right now is that it's very likely that individuals are either coming in close contact with persons who have the virus or touching contaminated surfaces and then touching their own surfaces. What are the symptoms of COVID-19? Well, currently, patients with COVID-19 have had mild to severe respiratory illness symptoms, either showing that they have a fever, or a cough, or a shortness of breath. There are some severe complications from this virus. Some patients develop pneumonia in both lungs and end up having multi-organ failure, and in some cases, leading to death. People can definitely help protect themselves from respiratory illness with everyday preventive actions. We know that avoiding close contact with people who are sick, avoiding touching your eyes, nose, and mouth with unwashed hands is another way to protect yourself. And then also washing your hands often with soap and water for at least 20 seconds. There have been a lot of campaigns around about proper hand washing hygiene. Those have been proliferating throughout. Definitely follow those. However, in the event that you don't have access to clean water and soap, you can use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. So The Lancet published this really interesting timeline for the coronavirus onset. This was based on individuals who contracted the illness in Wuhan, China. And what they looked at was to figure out, you know, from the onset of symptoms, the days of progression, when a person would be more likely to end up being hospitalized, when they would experience shortness of breath, when they would be declared to have acute respiratory distress syndrome, and then when they would be admitted to the intensive care unit. And what we see is that generally around the seventh day after the onset of symptoms, a person typically would end up hospitalized. One day after, they would see shortness of breath. 2 days after hospital admissions, they would essentially experience acute respiratory distress syndrome. And by the 10th and 11th day, they are likely to be hospitalized in the intensive care unit. So now I'm getting into sort of like what is the containment strategy for this? Currently, countries and medical facilities are, instituting this containment strategy. This is the sort of guidance that is currently presented by WHO and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. What we're seeing is that there's a two-pronged approach of having rapid identification of laboratory confirmed cases and then isolation of confirmed cases and the management in either a medical facility or at home of persons that test positive. So, how are we defining contact? How do you know if you have likely come into contact with someone that has COVID-19? Contact with the virus is defined as either you're providing direct care without proper personal protective equipment for COVID-19 patients, or either you are staying in the same closed environment with a COVID-19 patient, including it could be a workplace, it could be a classroom, household gatherings, and such, or you're traveling together in close proximity, so within 1 meter of a COVID-19 patient in any other conveyance within a 14-day period after their onset of symptoms. These three things are considered to be what's how we go about defining having come into contact with a person who has COVID-19. So, quarantine measures. There are three things that the CDC and the WHO suggest practitioners do in order to prevent the spread of the virus while providing care. The first one is to make sure that there is an appropriate quarantine setting and adequate provision for the period of quarantine. The next is to implement minimum infection prevention and control measures. And the third is to make sure there are minimum requirements for health monitoring of quarantine persons during the quarantine period. And I'll go over each of these in further detail throughout the rest of the presentation. So, appropriate quarantine arrangements include things such as making sure that those in quarantine are placed in adequately ventilated and spacious single rooms that, have an ensuite toilet, hand hygiene, and toilet facilities. If single rooms are not available, beds should be placed at least 1 meter apart. Suitable environmental infection controls such as adequate air ventilation, filtration systems, and waste management protocols should be in place. And we also recommend that maintenance of social distancing more than a meter of the person's quarantine should be definitely instituted at all times. Accommodation with an appropriate level of comfort can include making sure that the person has adequate food, water, and hygiene provisions. Protection for baggage and other possessions to make sure that those are situated within their reach. And then also appropriate medical treatment for existing conditions. If the person, has a chronic illness, they should also be able to get treatment for those also. And we need to make sure that, communication in a language that they can easily understand and can be easily explained is used. That's also a part of their rights. Also should be ha we should have provisions that will be made available to them. How long they will need to stay are things that we need to make sure we communicate. What will happen if they get sick? Just the typical order of care, and contact information for their local embassy or consular support if they happen to not be United States citizens. Assistance for quarantine travelers isolated or subject to medical examinations or other procedures for public health purposes is something that should also be provided. And assistance with communication with family members outside of the quarantine facilities should be facilitated. And if possible, access to the internet, news, and entertainment is something that you can provide to quarantine individuals. Something that's often forgotten is psychosocial support. Quarantined can, to some extent, be a isolating process that can have mental impacts, and we want to make sure that we're taking care of the whole of the person. And then also special considerations for older individuals and individuals with comorbidities due to their increased risk for severe COVID-19. Any person in quarantine who develops a feverish illness or respiratory symptoms at any point during the quarantine period should be treated and managed as a suspect COVID-19 case. In this instance, you will apply standard precautions for all persons quarantined and also quarantine personnel. And what you would do is perform hand hygiene frequently, particularly after contact with respiratory secretions, before eating and after using the toilet. Also, hand hygiene includes either cleaning hands with soap and water, as previously mentioned, or with an alcohol-based hand rub. The alcohol-based hand rubs are preferred if hands are not visibly soiled. Otherwise, you can wash hands with soap and water when they're visibly soiled. To ensure that all persons quarantined are practicing respiratory hygiene, you want to make sure that they are aware of the importance of covering their nose and mouth with a flexed elbow or paper tissue when coughing or sneezing, and then disposing immediately of the tissue. After that, they should perform hand hygiene, as aforementioned. And then it's also prescribed to also continue informing them of the importance to remain from touching their mouth, their nose, and their eyes. Administrative controls and policies for IPCs within a quarantine facility should include establishing sustainable infection prevention control infrastructures when considering the design of the facility and then also for activities. It should also require that there is education for persons quarantined and the quarantine personnel about IPCs. All personnel working in a quarantine facility need to have training on standard precautions before the quarantine measures are implemented. And at the same time, the same advice on standard precautions should be given to all quarantined persons on arrival. Both personnel and quarantined persons should understand the importance of promptly seeking medical care if at any point in time they develop symptoms. And then also, it should focus on developing policies on the early recognition and referral of a suspect COVID-19 case. So we're going to dive a little bit deeper around the environmental controls that are recommended. These are around cleaning and disinfecting procedures that must be followed consistently and correctly. Also, cleaning personnel need to be educated and protected from COVID-19 infections, just so we can make sure that environmental services are regularly and thoroughly cleaned throughout the quarantine period. So the guidance calls for cleaning in a myriad of ways. Environmental cleaning and disinfection procedures must be followed consistently and correctly, for sure. One thing is to start clean and disinfect frequently touched surfaces, such as bedside tables, bed frames, and other bedroom furniture daily with regular household disinfectant that is containing either, you know, diluted bleach solution of one part bleach, 99 parts water. It doesn't take too much of bleach for it to have a disinfecting outcome, so definitely you can stretch that. For surfaces that do not tolerate bleach, it's recommended that you use a product with 70% ethanol. To clean and disinfect a bathroom and toilet surfaces at least once daily, that should happen with a regular household disinfectant, again, containing diluted bleach. You should clean clothes, bed clothes, bath and hand towels, and sheets also, using regular laundry soap and water or machine wash at a temperature of 60 to 90 degrees with any common laundry detergent, and make sure you dry them thoroughly. It's suggested here that you should consider measures to ensure that waste is disposed of in a sanitary landfill and not in an unmonitored open area, for sure. And that cleaning personnel should wear disposable gloves when cleaning or handling surfaces such as clothing or linen that's been soiled with body fluids, and they should perform hand hygiene before and after removing gloves. So be sure to recommend that to your cleaning personnel. daily follow-up of persons quarantined should be conducted within the quarantine facility for the duration at which the person is under quarantine for, and should include daily body temperature checks and symptom screening. Groups of persons that are at higher risk of infection and severe disease outcomes may require additional surveillance for chronic conditions or the specific medical treatment. Be sure to keep that in mind. Also, considerations should be given to the resources, personnel, and rest period of staff at quarantine facilities. This is very important in the context of ongoing outbreak, during which limited public health resources may be better prioritized towards healthcare facilities and case detection activities. Also, laboratory testing of a respiratory sample from a quarantined person, irrespective of symptoms, is advised at the end of the quarantine period to make sure that you're not discharging individuals who could potentially still be a vector for spreading the virus. These are a couple of infographics that I think are very useful for sharing widely. One is definitely on hand hygiene, making sure that you use soap and water to wash your hands for at least 20 seconds. No touching of your eyes, nose, and mouth. And if you're not sick, it's not necessary for you to wear a mask. However, if you are ill and are coughing or sneezing, you should wear a mask in order to protect others. I hope that the information that I've provided has helped to increase your understanding of the precautionary measures that should be taken in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic. These resources were sourced from the World Health Organization and the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. If you would like to dive a little bit deeper, be sure to make sure you peruse information on those websites only. They have the most updated information and guidance. If you would like to reach out to me with additional questions, my email address is crystal.romeo@gmail.com. That's crystal, traditional spelling, .romeo@gmail.com. And you can also find me on Twitter at Dr. _Upperman, UPPERMAN. Thank you.